little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Well, a very hearty welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name is Bob Frelick, along with co-host
Julia Minton.
And Julia, why don't we start out by you saying something about how folks can get in touch with us and how they can get
Well, what was that awesome music, Bob?
Well, that awesome music was Think for Yourself by George Harab, who was a guest a few months back.
I never get tired of that. I always do a little sax solo when we're going out.
Oh, he's a wonderful humorist. He's a skeptic. He's a science promoter, a critical thinking promoter, and a musician primarily. So at any rate, tell folks how they can get to our podcast, to previous episodes, and how they can get in touch with us.
Well, Bob and I are real people, and we love to hear from you. So you can contact Bob and I directly. We have a Facebook page called Thinking Clearly Radio Show. Just put into your search bar on Facebook, Thinking Clearly Radio. Should come right up. And lastly, if you're a podcast junkie like I am, just open up your podcast app, go to add feed or search for new podcast, and put in Thinking Clearly. You'll see us come right up and just subscribe to your subscribe to Thinking Clearly, and you'll automatically get us in your ears every month.
It's easy as that. So I hope you enjoy this. I'm going to give you a little quote related to the topic for this episode. And it goes like this, quote, "In an increasingly complex world full of senseless coincidence, what's required in many situations is not more facts. We're inundated already, but a better command of the known facts. And for this, a course in probability is invaluable. Probability, like logic, is not just for mathematicians anymore. It permeates our lives." And that's from the closing chapter of a book published in 1988 called Enumeracy, Mathematical Illiteracy and Its Consequences by John Allen Paulos. And Professor Paulos is our guest for this evening, and I'm excited about that. That book has meant a lot to me throughout the years. So why don't you just frame the topic for us, Ju?
Well, yeah, with our guest, we're going to be talking about the importance of adding selected statistical topics to your critical thinking toolbox in order to help you understand and form accurate beliefs about the world we live in.
Okay, sharpen those tools and put them in the toolbox and take them out of the toolbox and use them all the time or
yes.
Most of the time.
We're not doing a whole statistics course here. We're just going through some of the basics so you can, it'll help you identify certain things and think about certain things in the future.
We're going to introduce some topics, but many years ago I bought and read this book, and it's called Enumeracy by John Allen Paulos, and he's a professor of mathematics at Temple University. And I just recently reread it, and when I opened the cover, I found a phrase that book had inspired me to write back in 1994. That phrase that just popped out of my mind after reading this book goes like this, quote, "Dream the possibilities and live the probabilities," end quote. And that phrase really meant a lot to me. We can talk a little bit about what that means, but probably not. It's still really the best book. Go ahead.
Just another insight to your far-out philosophies that I respect so much, Bob.
Well, what it is it's neat when you read a book and it somehow gels something in your mind that pops back out of your mind, rephrasing some of the importance of that book, and that's really what happened to me with this book.
Could you say that sentence again that stuck with you? Because it's great.
Dream the possibilities and live the probabilities. You know?
Yeah.
Dream the possibilities, what's possible, but when it comes to putting things into effect and implementing them, think about the probabilities.
I'm getting along with my neighbor.
Exactly. And at any rate, it's still the best book that I know that makes the point of the importance of knowing some math, and especially statistics, in order to accurately understand and form beliefs about the world that we live in. And if I was writing an endorsement for that book back then, Professor Paulos didn't ask me to do that because I didn't know him, he didn't know me, but I would have written something like this, quote, "With clarity and humor, Paulos teaches us many principles that can help us navigate the complex terrain of our modern world," end quote. So his other books, Professor Paulos, are his latest called Enumerate Life. He also wrote a book called Irreligion, a book called A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market. He wrote Beyond Innumeracy and A Mathematician Reads the Newspaper, also Once Upon a Number, and Mathematics and Humor, and I Think, Therefore, I Laugh. He's authored a number of scholarly papers on mathematical logic, probability, and the philosophy of science. John, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, thanks very much, Bob and Julia. Those were very, very kind words.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'll be there wherever it is I am.
You're everywhere now, even out in the universe now.
You're kind of like a wave duality.
And okay, well, I feel like collapsing. I'm tired.
Well, I know, and I very much appreciate the 3-hour time difference that we're experiencing.
No, I wasn't complaining.
I know. All right. Well, before we start, John, I want to mention that we're going to open the phone lines around 7:50 or so for callers to ask questions of you or comment on tonight's topic. So I'll start us off here. From that list of books that I read, I'm guessing that three important intellectual domains in your life have been mathematics, of course, writing, and humor. I'm interested in what the connection is between those three areas for you.
Well, in one sense, the connection is me. in a broader sense, I, as an undergraduate, maybe I should begin there. As an undergraduate, I majored in several different disciplines and flitted from one to another. I majored for a while in physics, in philosophy, and then in English for a while, and then even in classics. And I kept coming back to math. I'd take a semester and say, I think I'll major in English. I wanted to write. But ultimately, I returned to math, and but as a result, I have a more kind of unusual background than most mathematicians. So that was the seed that led to many of my books: how to use mathematical ideas and a kind of mathematical sensibility to enlighten or clarify, or at least provide a kind of quirky oblique light on different topics. And there's a quote by Wittgenstein that I like. He said that he looks forward to the day when philosophy ceases to exist as a noun, but becomes an adverb. You look at every topic philosophically. I mean, I wouldn't wish mathematics to disappear as a subject, but I think almost everything, to one degree or another, sometimes a great degree, sometimes not, can be looked at mathematically. And that's what I did in many of my books. The books that you listed, look at the world through a kind of mathematical lens and see what that gets you. And I think rubbing together two incongruous disciplines is almost a necessary, it's not sufficient, almost a necessary condition for creativity.
That explains the writing and the mathematics combined with the philosophy and science and things like that. And how did the humor pop up onto your radar?
Humor just seemed to, in a way, be something of a sort of mathematics. I mean, a lot of the same ideas play a role in humor as in mathematics. I mean, the self-reference certainly does. All kinds of jokes depend on self-reference or unusual juxtapositions and permutations. I mean, you have a dog, a greyhound with a tattoo of a bus on its side. It's not exactly a knee slapper, but it's a kind of reversal, logical paradoxes, incongruities, and they're all elements of humor, and of course in mathematics, and also the kind of approach. I mean, flavor. I mean, ingenuity and cleverness are hallmarks of both humor and mathematics. And so is a kind of Spartan, almost, economy of expression. I mean, long-windedness is antithetical to pure mathematics, and it usually is to good humor, too. You don't, except in Shaggy Dog stories, you don't want to tell a joke that's 6 minutes long. At the risk of being a bit long-winded myself, I'll you know, note that mathematical proof, or at least its beauty, often also depends on its elegance and brevity. And that's a difference between mathematics, or one difference, and other disciplines. I mean, if somebody writes a study of, I don't know, Kafka, his early life, and it's like 200 pages, and someone else writes one that's 900 pages long, I mean, that's not clear that, I mean, in the, that might be considered a better analysis, a more thorough analysis in literary history. But if somebody writes comes up with a theorem that's three pages long, and someone else comes up with one that's 29 pages long, the latter isn't considered better; it's considered worse. So brevity, elegance, as I say, is important in both mathematics and in humor. And catastrophe theory models certain kinds of jokes. I talk about that in mathematics and humor. Reductio ad absurdum. You follow an assumption to its absurd conclusion. That plays a role in both math and humor. I mean, in humor, it's more on the absurdum. In math, it's more on the reductio. But I always like to take things literally. I mean, you hear somebody saying, oh, you can get this at a fraction of the cost at our store. And I think to myself, yeah, the fraction is probably 5/3. or just silly little jokes, like teacher asks the class, what are two pronouns? Johnny, do you know two pronouns? And he says, who, me? Anyway.
No, it's a very interesting take. It's thank you for describing that, because I hear what you're saying, and I think I'm going to be thinking about jokes a little differently from now on.
Okay, here's a very bad mathematical joke that very few people like, even mathematicians. But if anybody likes it, more often than not, they're a mathematician. That is, how do you spell the name Henry? And people say, oh, it's H-E-N-R-Y. And I say, no, it's H-E-N-3-R-Y. The three is silent.
Okay, well, you know, that works.
Okay, sorry. I'll stop with the bad
one. No, that's fine.
No, it's great. Thank you.
Thanks for salting the humor in here.
That's a great explanation. Another theme that runs through your books is how important it is for all of us to understand basic principles of math, especially statistics. How do you make your case? Like, how can you help convince the unconvinced that understanding basic principles of math and statistics?
Sorry, I didn't interrupt.
No, go ahead.
One thing is that I don't think everyday stories, narratives, and statistics are that unrelated. They're not completely unrelated ways of thinking. I mean, in everyday life, there are words in English or in any natural language that are the precursors of technical words in probability, like mean, median, and mode. But there's words like nondescript, normal, middling, customary, so-so, medium, most, ordinary, and so on. All these are kind of rough, everyday versions that can be refined into words like technical words like mean, median, and mode. And same thing for standard deviation, which is, or variance. It's a technical statistical term, but in a way, it's just a refinement of words like extreme or different or far out or bizarre or deviant and so on. And even probability itself. I mean, the notion grew out of words like random, chance, likelihood, fortune, odds, fate, gods, even. So all these words are, in English, any formal language, any natural language can be refined and have been refined over the centuries into precise terms. And so many of us are like the Molière character, who was surprised that he'd been speaking prose his whole life. And I think, you have to get people to recognize that they've been speaking, no matter how bad their math they think their math background is, that they've been speaking probability their whole lives. Mm-hmm.
Even to say, oh, that would never happen.
The thing is, though, that most people's, notions of probability, not most, but a lot of people's, are very primitive. I mean, they have three words to describe likelihood, one in a million, 50-50, and sure thing. And that doesn't tell you very far. But yes, but you mentioned Bayes' theorem. I mean, Bayes' theorem allows you to update the probability of some event that you're interested in the light of new evidence.
Well,
and everybody does that. I mean, in an informal sense. I mean, you think something, and then something happens. You say, "Well, that's not as likely as I thought it was."
But, yeah, let's take a step back and
sure.
For those who aren't familiar about it, the because we threw out a lot of sort of topics that are related to that out there, but the Bayesian approach is something that's come up before. Could you kind of help listeners understand what a Bayesian approach is and what that means?
Well, it kind of gets like a technical. I mean, you can approach probability and statistics in a Bayesian way, which means you focus on the probability before you know anything, and then you update it, and you can use Bayes' theorem and probabilities. That leads to a whole approach to statistics, whereas the frequency approach, just you look at the probability of something as its long-run frequency. And, that's kind of simplistic what I just said, but it's basically kind of, tomes and tomes have been written about it, and unless you're going to go into probability statistics, I mean, the important thing is Bayes' theorem, which tells you how to change your estimate of the likelihood of some event. I mean, here's an example. Let's say you've got two coins on the table. One of them's a fair coin, and the other one's a two-headed coin. And you pick one up, but you don't look at it. And the chance that you picked up the fair coin, if there's only two coins, one two-headed and one fair, the chance you picked up the fair coin is a half. But what if you flip it three times and it comes up heads each time? That makes it less likely that it's the heads, as the fair coin. But less likely isn't very helpful unless you know exactly how much less likely. So the probability of having picked the fair coin initially, the so-called prior probability, is one half. But if you flip it three times and it comes up head each time, the probability that the coin you picked was the fair coin is now one ninth, not one half. And how you determine that is you use this result called Bayes' theorem, which tells you how to change your probabilities to get what's called your posterior probability, which is the probability after you've got some evidence.
Right. Basically, it's taking in new evidence, taking that into account, and then reexamining the situation, if it were.
In a statistically defensible way. And other than coin tosses, I mean, Bayesian approach has been used for a lot of real life things that we have to deal with that are important, like interpreting our probability of having a certain disease. If a woman gets a mammogram and has a positive test, what is really her probability of having breast cancer based on that test and the statistics of the probability of a woman her age actually having breast cancer, and you put those together with a Bayesian approach. And it's very astounding sometimes how our intuitive idea of how the statistics or percentage would come out conflicts with the more formalized Bayesian approach.
Right. I mean, there are lots of examples where some tests for breast cancer or whatever is, let's say, 98% positive. If you have that cancer, it turns out positive 98% of the time. And if you don't have it, let's say, just for symmetry's sake, it still turns out positive 2% of the time. So if you have it, the cancer is positive 98% of the time. If you don't have it, it'll still be positive 2% of the time, a false positive. And if it's a rare condition, let's say a half of 1%, and you go to the doctor and you test positive, it's very easy to get very depressed, say, oh, chance I have cancer is 98%, but that's not the case. If you have it, the test will be positive 98% of the time, but given the numbers I just gave, which are probably hard to digest on the radio, but if the test is positive, the probability you have cancer is only about 20%. I mean, it's still nothing to celebrate, but the probability of positive tests given cancer is 98%, but the probability of cancer given a positive test is only 20%. And, I mean, questions like this are often posed to medical students, and it's a little frightening that very often they're way off. They'll say something, a prospective doctor will say something like 98%.
Yeah, this is one of the instances where the where our intuitive answer runs us amok, and I can't underscore how too much how important it is, the Bayesian approach. And we'll be talking in future programs more about this, and I will post some information and links to further understanding of the Bayesian approach. But that's one of those tools that you can sharpen up and put in your toolbox to get out when you need it as a critical thinker.
I couldn't agree more. Actually, I mean, I mentioned doctors, but many people, I mean, doctors in particular, are, to use a term I like, maybe used too much, innumerate. I remember a number of years ago, a long time ago, my wife had was contemplating a minor procedure. She was nervous, and we went to the doctor, and he reassured her. He says, "Don't worry, it's one in a million risk." And then a little while later, this very short consultation, he says, "You know, don't worry about it. It's 99% safe." And then as we're going out the door, he says, "Calm down. It usually goes quite well." But the numbers meant nothing to him. From one in a million to 99%, that's one in 100, to usually, which is one in 10. I mean, the numbers were just decoration. They didn't mean anything. And that's often the way people treat numbers. Like, you just sprinkle them around the story, and they don't really mean anything.
Well put. You know, some of the statistical topics that you've talked about in your book and that seem relevant to critical thinking, those tools we were hoping folks will sharpen up and use, are, I'm just going to read off a list of them, independent versus dependent events. It's a principle used in statistics. The multiplication principle, underestimating the frequency of coincidences, in which you go in your book in numeracy and talk and work through predictive dreams. If we think we have a dream that predicts the future, what is the probability of that, that we indeed have a predictive dream versus it's just an artifact of statistics?
I'm not going to wake up in a classroom naked, am I?
Worse than that is teaching in front of a class and realizing they're naked.
Yeah, that's the teacher's predictive dream.
That's
a scary thing. Or that you come into a class and you're totally unprepared. That's another one that is pretty frequent with instructors. The gambler's fallacy is another one. Regression to the mean. Conjunctive probability, the law of large numbers, the central limit theory, and correlation versus causation.
That's a good one.
That's a good one, and we've talked about that on this show before. But we can't cover all of these. But let's talk about a couple of these that you think are the most important for critical thinkers to understand.
Well, I mean, independent versus dependent events is an important thing. I mean, two events are independent if the occurrence of one doesn't affect the probability of the other one's occurring. It doesn't make the probability of the other one's occurring more or less likely. And if that's the case, the probability they're both occurring is the product of their probabilities. And that holds for not just two events, but three or four or 29 events. So if you flip a coin twice, those events are independent. The result of the first flip doesn't affect the likelihood that the second flip is going to land heads or tails. When that's the case, you multiply their respective probabilities. So in that case, it's a half times a half. The 1/4 is the probability of getting two heads in a row. Three heads in a row is a half cubed, 1/8, and so on. And so it's easy to figure out the probability of a bunch of independent events occurring. It's just the product of their probabilities. So if, let's say, if events really are independent, a set of the probability they're all occurring is generally going to be tiny, because even if the probability of any particular one of them might be 99%, the probability all 20 of them, all 100 of them occur is small. And so the probability, for example, of 3,000 people dying in New York on a single day would be, you know, minuscule. if the events were really independent, 3,000 independent deaths, the probability of that is, as I said, it would be tiny. But the 3,000 people who died in New York on 9/11, those deaths were not independent. They were all part of the same incident. And so it's still unlikely, but nowhere near as unlikely. And you run into problems in the stock market, too. People figure the probability of all these things occurring is very small, so I'll be safe if I invest here and there. But if the events are dependent, in other words, they're connected, the probability of one does affect the probability of the other, the sequence of events may not be that improbable. And there's examples in the history of finance where that's been the case. And whole organizations have collapsed on a bet that certain events were independent involving various stocks when they were not. They were dependent.
These principles in statistics that we're talking about are nothing that involve calculus or any advanced mathematics. Most of the calculations are just basic arithmetic and understanding principles involved. So that's independent and dependent. Do you have another one that you think bears on critical thinking?
Let's see.
Let me nudge you towards regression to the mean, because I think that's an important one.
Okay, regression to the mean is the phenomenon whereby a very extreme result is often followed by a result that's closer to the average. I mean, let's say you're throwing darts at a target, and you're so-so. You generally hit the target, I don't know, 10 out of 25 times. But one day you're feeling good or you're lucky and you hit the target 19 out of 25 times. You almost never do that, but it happens there. I mean, but the next time you do it, that confluence of events that resulted in you getting lucky, so to speak, and hitting the target 19 out of 25 instead of your usual 10, that's unlikely to happen again. And next time you're going to probably get 12 or 8 or 9, so you regress to the mean. Another example is very tall parents generally have kids that are shorter than they are, or likewise very short parents usually have kids who are taller than they are. So, let's say the same thing with, let's say, the player that appears on the cover of Sports Illustrated or something. He has a stellar performance 1 month, which is unlikely for him or her. But the following month, the performance is probably going to regress to the mean. It'll be much more in line with what the athlete usually does. So there's people talk about the Sports Illustrated jinx, whereby, you know, stellar athletes appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and then the next month or the next season they do very poorly. It's not a jinx. It's what you'd expect to happen. I mean, an extreme result generally is followed by one less extreme.
Sure, that kind of makes sense. Yeah, could you help me wrap my brain around the gambler's fallacy?
I like your misstatement before. I think it's good. The gambler's fantasy.
Well, right. I mean, it does kind of actually speak to the description, right?
It rolls off the tongue.
I think we should do that.
I suspect we might have some folks who like to take chances and risks in the audience, and maybe it's something they could reflect on or identify with.
Yeah, well, it's the idea that it's sometimes called the Monte Carlo fallacy. It's that something, if it happens more frequently than normal during a given period, it'll happen less frequently in the future. If you get a long string of heads, you're more likely to get a tail next time. And the fallacy is, you know, I've got to run now. I've got to run as successes. I'm going to keep betting, and that's likely to change. Or I have a run of losses. My luck's got to change, and I'll keep going. So even though I'm losing money, things are going to even out, and I'll win. If you just look at a simple case of coin tossing, if you get a bunch of heads in a row, or not necessarily all heads, but 20 heads out of 30 flips, the next 30 flips, again, it's related a little bit to, it can be made to relate strongly to regression to the mean. The next 30, you're unlikely to have 20 out of 30 heads. I mean, you're unlikely to go in the other direction. So, the fallacy or the fantasy is that what's happening is going to continue to happen, or the opposite will happen. I mean, people have confused ideas about probability, but it's usually stated if something happens more frequently during a given period, it'll happen less frequently in the following period, but that's not always the case.
Yeah, we can go to any casino and see that one in action, can't we?
Right. casinos are in business because, on the average, people lose money. They wouldn't be there otherwise, except for Trump's casinos.
Trump's casinos, yeah.
They somehow manage to lose money anyway.
I want to remind folks that we are talking to John Allen Paulos, Professor of Mathematics at Temple University and author of many books, including Innumeracy. And the topic is mathematics and statistical topics that are important for your critical thinking toolbox in order to understand and form accurate beliefs in the world that we live in. You know, one of my favorite examples in your book, Innumeracy, is the stock market scam, where the lesson is there's always...
Isn't that just called the stock market?
Yeah, same thing. Okay, all right.
What did you?
I'm joking with Bob. I'm trying to keep him on his toes.
She messes with me quite a bit, John. But the stock market.
You said the stock market.
I said that's just a stock market scam. That's just called the stock market, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. You don't need. Yeah, it's redundant.
Go on, Bob.
Oh, okay. The lesson there is that there's always enough random success to justify almost anything. To someone who wants to believe, can you describe that for us?
Sure. Let's say there's a would-be publisher of a stock newsletter, and he writes letters to people, and he wants people to subscribe to his stock newsletter. And he brags about his inside contacts and his supercomputers and his sophisticated econometric models. And he said, but you don't have to believe me. Just watch what I do. And so he sends this cover letter saying how great it is, but see what I do. And let's say he sends a second letter to 64,000, just to make the arithmetic easy, 64,000 potential subscribers to his stock newsletter. And to 32,000 of them, he predicts the stock markets, let's say some stock index, is going to go up the following week. And to the other 32,000, he predicts it's going to go down the following week. And whatever happens, he's right to the 32,000 people. So let's say it goes up. He focuses on them only. Once he sent he predicted that the market will go up to. And to 16,000 of those 32,000, he predicts it'll go up again the second week. To 16,000 of that 32,000, half of them, he predicts it'll go down the second week. And again, one thing or the other will happen. Let's say it goes down the second week. Now he's got 16,000 people to whom he sent two straight correct predictions. And to these 16,000 only, every time he makes an incorrect prediction, he throws out those people, so to speak. And to the 16,000, he sends a third letter and says, next week, the third week, the market is going to go up. He predicts that to 8,000 of the 16,000. To the other 8,000, he predicts it'll go down. And again, one thing or the other will happen, and he'll have 8,000 people to whom he sent three straight correct predictions, always focusing on the people that he only sends correct predictions to and ignoring the others, so forgetting about them. And you iterate this a few more times, and that's you've got, let's say, 6 weeks in a row, and you get 8,000, 4,000, 2,000. You got 1,000 people who have received six straight correct predictions from you. And then you send a letter to them, and you say, I told you what I could do. I told you my assets, my everything I'm connected to, supercomputers and so on. And you can see I can do what I predicted. These 1,000 people have received six consecutive straight predictions, and he says, if you want to continue to receive my oracular predictions, you're going to have to send me $1,000 to subscribe to my stock newsletter. And if they all do that, they might very well be influenced by the fact he's been right six times in a row. If they all do that, that's 1,000 times 1,000, $1,000,000, and he doesn't have to know anything. These aren't really predictions. I mean, predictions that you can put in quotation marks. But he could easily appeal to people who, as Bob just said, want to believe, and there's nothing to it. And, you know, it's kind of an extreme version of many stock pundits. I mean, their predictions are very nebulous and can be interpreted as being right. Excuse me, X times in a row, and people will subscribe. And versions of this exact thing actually are carried out in sports betting. Yeah, and it's not, the stakes aren't big enough for states, excuse me, for states' attorneys general to prosecute. But you could send out 32,000 letters to say Ohio State will beat Michigan. To the other, 32,000, Michigan will win. Whatever happens the next week, you could say, Penn State will beat Northwestern, and or Northwestern will beat Penn State. And, yeah, you could have six games in a row, and the stakes are lower. They don't charge $1,000, but this is commonly done.
Mm-hmm. Seems like what people might call playing the numbers, I guess.
Playing the numbers. Television evangelists who they say, right now, the Spirit of the Lord will come in you and your pain will go away. And for some people, the pain will go away and they might send in money to finance the church or likely the con man.
That's one of my favorite examples of how important these principles of statistics can be in our assessment of events and issues and decision making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if someone were to predict something reliably six times and you go, oh, gee, how could that happen?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's quite convincing, but here's one very good example of how that might happen in a not very true and honest way.
You could send me $1,000 if you like.
I was going to say, I think I found my next business opportunity. It sounds like a great idea.
No, I think it was my business opportunity.
Well, I'm looking for partners.
Okay, all right, sounds good.
So I could see how that would be very useful in for a critical thinker to kind of take those sorts of things into account. Do you have any other resources you could recommend for critical thinkers to sharpen their statistical critical thinking tools or to enhance that critical thinking toolbox?
Jordan Ellenberg's books are good. You're not even wrong, or the title has wrong in it. I'm not quite sure the exact title. Of course, I mean, going back in time, Martin Gardner, I mean, they're kind of straightforward. The internet allows for more obfuscations or more confusion. I mean, there's so many articles, so many sources of information and misinformation on the internet that people have access to that they never used to have access to. It's much easier to concoct a kind of Pizzagate kind of story.
Absolutely.
And actually, another kind of notion that's less widely known is a conjunction fallacy, which is very counterintuitive. one example is the following. Let's say there's a U.S. senator, Senator Jones, and he's a devoted family man. He's lives modestly. He's a solid guy, family man, and so on. And so this is definitely accepted about Senator Jones, modest, honest, whatever. And so given that background, what's more likely, that he received a bribe of $50,000, or he received a bribe of $50,000 to pay for his daughter's medical treatment? So A, he received a bribe for $50,000, or B, he received a bribe of $50,000 to pay for his daughter's medical treatment. Which of those two options is more likely, given his background?
I've been tricked by this one before.
Yeah, we talked about this when we talked about the Thinking Fast and Slow, Kahneman and Tversky's work on that.
And right. the gut it's reaction is the specifics. It's, yeah, you know, the bribe with the daughter's surgery or whatever, yeah, because it
we love stories, we love narratives, and we imagine it, and it's so powerful and strong. But
the likelihood, yeah, is actually the first one, because it's less specific.
You draw two circles, and you'll see vivid graphically why the conjunctive probability is less.
And I think that's
right. I mean,
it's a very good example
of two things occurring is less likely, always less likely than the probability that one of them will occur. Because probability of two things is harder to satisfy two conditions than it is to satisfy just one of them. But a general lesson to draw from this is that there's a kind of tension between probability and plausibility. Because mm-hmm. if you add more details to a story, it becomes more plausible. But at the same time, it becomes less probable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you want to lie, you put in details. But on the other hand, the probability of the conjunction of your statements is smaller.
That's very relevant to the internet. To bring that up specifically, because I know, you know, I experience often, I'll see an article of, you know, some freak thing happens, you know, these particular pair of shoes cause you to be struck by lightning, you know,
and
it happens to one person, and then everybody's freaking out, and there's a boycott on those shoes, and they're, you know, all kinds of terrible things. But if you were to frame it in a different way and say, oh, you know, this one thing happened to one person, without all those details, without the vivid scene that gets clicks on the internet, not as exciting or outraging.
Right. It's very easy to concoct things, and because there's so much available, and it seems more plausible because you can put in all kinds of things. Yeah, so I mean, I think it's one reason for the rise of fake news, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. John, talking about, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but talking about fake news and talking about this post-truth era that we live in, and we were talking about resources, important resources, I would love to nudge you to write an updated Innumeracy, because you've got all the issues, all the topics, and the humor in Innumeracy, but you're also talking about references that are back in the 80s, whereas we have so much material in 2019 now that if there's anything I could do to nudge you in that direction, it would be wonderful.
You've got a big fan over here.
All right. Well, I'll consider it. I may have considered it, but I'll give it some thought, Bob.
All right.
Okay.
But a lot, even though a lot has happened, I mean, a lot of the basic math is the same. I mean, like the difference between mean and median, it's still most people, and often most politicians, or at least they pretend not to know the difference. I mean, mean incomes and keep going up, and the median income doesn't.
Hmm.
I mean, I'd like to presidential debate sometimes if they just ask, you know, what's the difference between the mean and the median? And I mean, Republicans will stress the mean, Democrats will stress the median. But
can you explain how the median income would go up and the mean income would come down? Because it's all just averages to me.
Yeah, well, the mean will go up because lots of people, the so-called 1% or 2% or 0.1%, their income is gargantuan, and that brings up the average. But the median isn't the average, it's the middle income. If you range everybody's income or assets, whatever dimension you're going on, and say income, all 320 or 330 million Americans, the middle one, when their incomes are arranged in increasing order, the middle one might have income of $50,000, even if the average income is, I'm just picking a number out of the air, is $300,000.
Sure.
Why? Because you've got all these super rich people, and when you average in their incomes, it brings up the average. It
right.
doesn't affect the median very much. Same thing with the neighborhood. You have a very poor neighborhood, and Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett move into it. The median goes way up, but the median isn't affected at all.
Sure. So that very small minority of people basically kind of offset the balance.
Right. They bring the median up, the mean up, but not the median.
And then you have the third measure of central tendency, the mode.
Right. The mode is just the most likely or one of the most likely incomes.
Yeah. All right. Well, are there any other ideas topics that you? I just want to see if there's anything else that's on your mind at this particular time for you to get out to the listeners, and then we'll open up the phone lines.
One kind of nice thing is, given that I teach at a university, I'm conscious of this. The difference between an average class size or the size of a class seen by a typical student. So let's say you've got in a certain department, there's three courses or three classes. One's with 100 students, the other is with 10, and the third is with 10. So the average of 100 and 10 and 10 is 40. That's 120 divided by 3. But the typical student, you can do the arithmetic, in a typical student's view, there are 85 other students. The typical student sees 85 other students because each of the students in the class with 100 sees 100, is in a class with 100. Each of the ones in classes of size 10 sees 10. And kind of glossing over the explanation, 100 squared plus 10 squared plus 10 squared divided by the 120 students is 85. So the size of a class as seen by a typical student is 85, even though the average class size is 40. So the university will, of course, stress 40, but the student will, typical student will see 85 students in his class.
Mm-hmm.
So any case, a lot of this is hard to see on the radio.
There's a special kind of math called radio math, and it's slightly more challenging than the rest
actually,
of math.
Actually, just numbers.
Just arithmetic.
The annual budget of the National Science Foundation is $7 billion. The Food and Drug Administration, $5 billion. The Centers for Disease Control is $11 billion. And the sum of that is like 200 times less than the cost of the wars in Iraq and Iran.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just
one 200th. I don't like when people say three times less because that's always confusing.
Yeah.
but 1/100th.
Relative versus absolute. I want to impress upon the listeners, it's just basic arithmetic combined with some really important concepts. We're going to open the phone lines now. Professor John Allen Paulos, he's professor of mathematics at Temple University, talking about the importance of basic math and statistical principles in terms of things that we want to put in our toolbox for critical thinking. So give us a call and let us know what's on your mind. Do you have any other things, Julie? I have something that I want to get back. Okay. Regression to the mean. You know, I used to teach introductory psychology, and the class size used to be about 60. And based on your book, it gave me the idea to do this demonstration of ESP. And what the demonstration is, we use these Zener cards, which are 25 cards, five each different symbols on them, like a square, a circle, squiggly lines. They're used to test psychic abilities. And I'd have the students pair up and test each other. And then they would report what each person's score is. Well, you'd expect just by chance alone that a typical or an average score would be 5 out of 25. But we got some folks that were scored up into, 9 or more better. And that 9 gives you there's a 95% chance that that can happen by chance alone, or would score very low, in the 2 or 3, something like that. And then I would take the people that were scored very high and the people that scored very low, call them up in front of the class and put them on the side of me, one to the left and one to the right in a line. And I would pass these objects to them that I said were given to me by a shaman in Guatemala. And one was a crystal and one was like a conch. And the shaman said that that crystal would enhance people's ESP ability and the conch would drain away people's ESP. And I would have the people that had the high scores, I would have them pass the conch down the line. The people who had the low scores pass the crystal down the line. And then we would retest the groups, both to the right and left of me. And Professor, what happened?
The regression to the mean suggested that these conch and crystals actually work.
Yes. And then I'd have the assignment was for students to form a hypothesis and write a paper about what they thought happened. And I got a lot of wacky ideas about what happened. A few people got it and actually knew the term regression to the mean is the most probable thing that happened in this case. I had one student who came up to me after the class and said, "You know what? I had an experience with a shaman in South America,
too." What kind of crystal was it?
It was some kind of shiny crystal. It might have mattered. Oh, it might have, but it was a good illustration because almost to the person, the people with the high scores regressed to the mean, went down, their scores went down, and the people with the low scores went up. It's a really neat demonstration, and your book inspired me to do that.
Yeah, I like that example. Yeah, you could, if you wanted to switch to the dark side, you could make money with that.
Yeah, the
selling crystals.
The crystal conch scam.
Yeah, right. I like it. Oh, I was just going to say, it reminds me of a problem that I often mention in an introductory probability class. I said, there's two people, and you flip a coin 100 times in front of each of them, and person A correctly predicts, whether it's heads or tails, 52 out of the 100 times, and person B correctly predicts, whether it's heads or tails, 29 out of 100 times. And which person's performance is more in need of an explanation, is more extraordinary? And, people often think, 52, he did a fairly good job. But I point out how unlikely it is that someone only predicted 29 out of 100 flips. Mm-hmm. And that's extraordinarily unlikely. And if you knew such a person, you should follow him around, and whatever he says, make sure you negate it, and much more often than chance, you'll be right. It's always good to know somebody who's always wrong or almost always wrong. Anyway, people find that counterintuitive, which I guess it is. Anyway, I might as well put in a plug for my most recent book. You mentioned
it.
A Numerate Life talks about my life, and it kind of intersperses personal experiences with the mathematics, which sheds some light on it. So it's back and forth between a bit of mathematics and a bit of anecdote. So it's a kind of mathematically flavored memoir, and people might find it interesting. A Numerate Life.
A Numerate Life.
Very interesting, yeah.
And give us a few highlights from that.
I talk about a saying my father always used to have, that there are two kinds of people in the world, the very strange ones and the ones you don't know very well. And I illustrated that mathematically, in fact, geometrically, Again, it's not doesn't lend itself to radio math, but you can actually give some mathematical content to that phrase, and it also shows that everybody is strange along some many dimensions, and
The Doors thought so. People are strange.
Well, here at KMUD, we're proving it every day. I have to say, I really appreciate the way that you see math interlaced into everything. I can kind of relate a little bit, and I think it's just a really interesting, fascinating way to see the world, and I hope more people can sort of appreciate that outlook.
All right. Well, thanks, Julia. I appreciate your kind words and Bob's as well.
And I realized from your books there is something I'm not very good at, which is spelling, because I cannot spell enumeracy for the life of me. I've tried numerous times. So there's that.
You just have to remember the two N's, I and N.
Yeah.
But I tried putting like an O-U-S in there, and it's really – I majored in a few things. English was not one of them.
Actually, sometimes people confuse enumeracy with numerology. Say, oh, you wrote a book on numerology. It says, no, to the extent I have anything to say about numerology is that it's nonsense.
Professor John Allen Paulos, professor of mathematics at Temple University. And by the way, you've been there for 45 years. Do I have that right?
Approximately, yeah. I can't count that high.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Good arithmetic.
That's wonderful. And one of the things, if we ever have you back as a guest, that I want to ask is how students have changed through those years. We don't have time to talk about that, but I'm throwing it out there. It's almost the top of the hour. So I want to thank you very much, especially since the hour is late in your neck of the woods. Thank you.
Okay, I want to thank both of you as well. I enjoyed it, and thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
And I want to thank our wonderful engineer, Eric, who gave us a salute, and we salute you back, Eric Allen, for doing a great job engineering. And thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. Okay. Buenas noches. Until next time, keep thinking clearly.
Great. Bye-bye.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.